Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
The Mona Lisa, The Last Supper. These masterworks of the Renaissance were painted by the hand of Leonardo da Vinci. He is the archetype of what we think of today as a Renaissance man. His infinite curiosity led him to study anatomy, botany, music, sculpture, design. And, says writer Fritjof Capra, Leonardo da Vinci was also a great scientist. Capra is the author of a new book, The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. Hello, Mr. Capra.
Hello, thank you for having me on your show.
Surely. Now, Leonardo da Vinci is now known, of course, to have been a great artist, a great mind, but he was not classically trained in science or math. Tell us a brief story.
No, he was not, but he was classically trained in art. And also in engineering. He lived in a time in the 15th century in Florence where there was a great unification of various disciplines. And he was trained in all these disciplines, but he was not trained as a scientist. In fact, he did not go to university and therefore could not speak Latin or Greek. And that was a big hindrance on the one hand, but on the other hand, it allowed him to not be prejudiced by the classical teachings and to go to nature herself, as he would say, to observe nature systematically.
Exactly. In your book, you write that his lack of classical education freed him.
That's right. And he often commented on that. And one of my favorite quotes is when he said, "When you can go to the well, you don't go to the water jug." In other words, you don't need to read the classical texts, which of course he studied also, but you have a more direct access to natural phenomena. And this is what we now call the empirical method or the scientific method, which he developed single-handedly 100 years before Galileo, who is usually called the father of modern science. So in my view, that honor should really go to Leonardo da Vinci.
Give us a sense of how the other young scientists were approaching their work. What was da Vinci seeing around him that was different?
Well, not science, of course. In fact, the word science was not used in our sense until the 19th century. Instead of science, they would use natural philosophy. And those philosophers would generally just copy Greek texts. So Aristotle, of course, first and foremost, really ruled the day. And then the scholastic philosophers of the Middle Ages, the Christian theologians, fused Aristotelian philosophy and science with Christian doctrine. And so then any contradiction to Aristotle, any even critical reading of Aristotle, was seen as being heretical. And this is the tradition with which Leonardo broke.
His notebooks are full of clues about how his mind worked. For example, Leonardo da Vinci was preoccupied with motion, you write, especially the flow of water.
Yes, and that is a science that is now known as hydrodynamics or fluid dynamics that he really created. That did not exist at all. There were a lot of hydraulic engineers, especially in Lombardy, in northern Italy, who were very talented and very knowledgeable about the flow of water. But Leonardo was the only one who made the transition from engineering to science by asking, how can I represent the flow of water mathematically? How can I describe it in theoretical models? That was absolutely unheard of.
So tell me about some of the experiments that he devised to look at water.
Well, for instance, he did controlled experiments in the laboratory. He designed a glass tank to study turbulent flow, and he painted the wall behind it black. And then he poured water into this tank and colored it or put fine grains of millet or straw into it. And these are techniques now known as flow visualization that are still used by scientists today.
Da Vinci was also interested in patterns that he saw in nature. There are wonderful prints that you include in your book. One is the pattern of rivers on the earth seen from above.
Yes.
And another is the pattern of veins in the human arm. And they
look
so much alike.
Yes, and this is actually the main thesis of my book. I present a new interpretation of Leonardo's science as a science of patterns, of living forms, of processes of transformation that comes very close often to what we now know as the theory of living systems and complexity theory. For him, to know something always meant to relate it to similar patterns in other fields. And this is why Leonardo sounds so modern to us.
One of my favorite parts of your book is where you talk about how his sense of the mystery of life translated into that enigmatic smile that you see in the Mona Lisa.
Yes, and that is especially true for the later parts of his life, for his old age. That smile appears also in the St. John and in many other figures in his drawings. And in addition to the smile, we often have a finger pointing heavenwards. So that mysterious smile at that finger pointing into the darkness is Leonardo's acknowledgement that nature, in fact, will always be more complex and more mysterious than our human science can explain.
Fritjof Capra, the author of The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. Sir, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There is a new form of guilt going around. Call it carbon guilt. It's found among people who feel their lifestyle, driving, flying, or maybe just leaf blowing, adds too much carbon dioxide to the air. The guilty can buy something called a carbon offset. Essentially, you pay someone else to reduce or offset carbon emissions equal to your own. It is a booming business, and now the federal government is worried that consumers are getting ripped off. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on a new investigation into the carbon offset market.
It works like this. You go to a broker and pay to offset, say, 20 tons of carbon dioxide. That's about the average each American adds to the air annually. The going price these days for a ton of CO2 is about $5. The broker promises that your money will pay for a project somewhere that will reduce carbon emissions by 20 tons. Say, by growing trees that soak up CO2 or building a solar energy plant. Pankaj Bhatia of the World Resources Institute, an environmental think tank, says business is hot.
Amazing, in a word.
Last year, experts reckon the trade in the U.S. was about $100 million and growing fast. Bhatia assesses carbon footprints, how much carbon you or your business emits. He says he's been very busy.
Today I got a phone call from a group that is managing concerts, and they wanted to know how they can quantify emissions from the transportation by helicopters of their equipment.
That's because the concert promoters wanted to buy offsets to neutralize the CO2 their concert produced. But how do the promoters know what they're paying for? After all, this is a market that trades in, well, gas, or more accurately, units of gas that are not produced. In the U.S., this trading is voluntary and no one is in charge. That worries consumer advocates.
Our concern is that because these claims are very hard to substantiate and consumers can't easily tell whether they're getting what they pay for, that there is the real possibility of fraud in this market.
That's Jim Kalm. He's in the Enforcement Division of the Federal Trade Commission. Kalm says he doesn't know yet if there's much fraudulent carbon trading, but he's suspicious.
There's been an explosion in green marketing. There are claims that we didn't see in the marketplace 10 years ago. Carbon offsets are one of those new claims.
So the FTC has decided to investigate. One of the things they'll look into is double selling.
So, for example, if I have solar panels on the top of my store and then I sell somebody else the right to claim that carbon scrubbing, I can't then claim the carbon scrubbing for myself as well. And if somebody were selling that twice, three times, then that would be a deceptive practice that the FTC would need to take action.
Another hang-up is whether the carbon savings they're buying would have happened anyway. For example, what if a company cuts back on the electricity it uses simply to save money? Can that company then claim it's created an offset and sell it? Climate experts say no. The offset market, they say, is meant to pay for carbon reductions that would not have happened otherwise. Some environmental groups say that instead of buying carbon offsets, Americans should just do the hard work themselves, use less electricity, switch from coal to wind power, or drive less. But Eric Carlson of Carbon Fund, a company that trades in offsets, says it doesn't really matter who cuts carbon, who pays for those cuts, or who profits.
We need a 70 or so percent reduction in emissions, and in fact, that's all the planet actually cares about. It doesn't care about electricity versus methane versus this versus coal versus whatever.
But the FTC does care about consumers and whether they're getting what they pay for. The commission will hold its first public hearing on offset trading on January 8th in Washington, D.C. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
If you want to check up on your own carbon offsets, you can find some suggestions at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We've all heard about the polar bears suffering in the Arctic because of global warming, but that's far from the only species that's hurting. The Pacific walrus has had it especially tough. And as the Alaska Public Radio Network's Annie Feit reports, wildlife managers are working on plans to respond.
To the human eye, the Chukchi Sea between Alaska and Russia may look like a remote and forbidding environment. But for female walrus, it's an all-you-can-eat seafood buffet. The animals float along on ice platforms, letting the currents take them to nutrient-rich areas where they can dive to the ocean bottom for clams and mussels.
As far as human memory goes, walrus have used the Chukchi Sea in the summer to forage.
Tony Fishbach is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He spent the summer tracking walrus he tagged off the northern coast of Alaska, and he watched in disbelief as the massive Arctic ice sheet retreated north in mid-July.
Within the Chukchi Sea, there was no ice at all.
At first, there were small chunks of ice called remnants, but they didn't last very long.
When that ice was gone, they had no choice but to come to shore.
In August, thousands of walrus began showing up along Alaska's north coast. It was something that had never been seen before. Joel Garlick Miller is a walrus biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the agency was caught off guard.
This was the first time I had ever heard of such an event, and we didn't quite know how to respond initially. We were trying to say, okay, well, is this just something that if they're going to come ashore for a little while and move on?
As it turned out, the walrus were there to stay. And while Garlick Miller kept his eye on the Alaska animals, a Russian colleague was watching an even more dramatic scene play out on his side of the Chukchi Sea. Anatoly Kochnev is a biologist in Chukotka on the northern coast of Russia, where walrus gathered in groups as large as 30,000 animals. He says by fall, the adults looked very undernourished.
They were quite underweight. There was a lot of animals that definitely were starving. And I could also detect some skin diseases. Skin was cracked and wouldn't heal.
Kochnev believes most of the calves in Russia died. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is just starting to get a handle on what all this means for the walrus population as a whole. Rosa Meehan heads the agency's Marine Mammal Division in Alaska. She says it's scary how fast the Arctic environment is transforming.
It's difficult to really come to grips with this because what we're seeing, it's not just that the ice is going away and the ice is a platform. Ice is more than just, you know, something physical to stand on. It's actually an ecosystem. And what we're seeing is this dramatic ecosystem change. And so it's clear that's going to have a lot of ramifications for all the species that depend on it.
Meehan says this winter, her department is beginning to work out what types of conservation efforts may be necessary to protect walrus. They're also planning more studies for next summer to better understand how the animals are responding to this changing environment. For NPR News, I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
Pharmaceutical manufacturers routinely shower doctors with free drug samples, and they've long claimed that they do so in part so doctors can pass the medicine along to poor patients. Well, a new study challenges that claim. NPR's Joanne Silberner has details.
Physician Richard Barron practices medicine in Philadelphia. Some of his patients are poor, but he won't even take the time to talk to the drug company representatives who stop by to offer free samples.
It's typically the wrong medications. It's not to say never, but the medications that they give us are the most expensive, the newest, the ones we know the least about, the ones that, as recent experience has shown, may have side effects that we don't know about yet.
Up in Boston, physician Sarah Cutrona shares his concerns. She says free medications can change the way physicians practice for the worse.
You want to go to your doctor and get the medication that he or she feels is most appropriate for you, not the medication that's on the shelf.
But Cutrona began thinking the free giveaways might have an upside. So several years ago, she started a study.
We're looking to see, is the use of free samples overall such an overwhelming positive? Because without the free samples, we wouldn't be getting medications to our needy patients.
Cutrona is a doctor with the Cambridge Health Alliance, a Boston-area health system that's affiliated with Harvard Medical School. She and colleagues took a close look at a government health survey of 33,000 people. Participants were asked, among other things, whether they had received any free prescription drug samples in the previous year. The analysis is published in the current issue of the American Journal of Public Health. It shows 12% of Americans got free drug samples in 2003. But Cutrona wasn't happy.
Few samples actually went to needy patients. Insured Americans and those with higher income were actually more likely to report receiving free drug samples.
Not that doctors were favoring those rich people with health insurance, she says. It was more a matter of poorer people not seeing personal physicians as often, if at all. About 11% of low-income people received at least one free sample, compared to 13% of people with high incomes.
So these free samples really are not a safety net.
An official at the drug company Trade Group Pharma says there are medication subsidy programs to help poor people. Free samples are for something else.
Samples are made available to physicians when drugs are launched so that physicians can get some experience with those drugs. Physicians may also use samples to get a patient started on a drug before they can go to the pharmacy and pick up a prescription.
But that comes back to Cutrona and Barron's concerns that free samples tend to be new drugs, which means they're usually more expensive and don't have a long safety record. That's especially a problem with chronic conditions such as high cholesterol or serious heartburn, where patients may be on the drugs for many years. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we're going to hear about a science experiment that explores the power of the mind. Thousands of studies have shown that a significant portion of people given a sugar pill will respond to that sham treatment just as if it were actual medication. Their symptoms get better. It's known as the placebo effect. Now, the question is whether a suggestion, just a few words, could have that same effect. NPR's Elise Spiegel reports on an experiment involving hotel maids that suggests the answer is yes.
There are four flights of stairs at the Adams Inn in Washington, D.C., each with around 14 steps. Mariana Polanco works at the inn as a housekeeper, and so she knows these steps pretty well. She explains that she climbs the stairs 9 or 10 times a day.
Every day I bring vacuum upstairs. Whack.
Polanco is a smallish woman, and the vacuum, a large yellow contraption, is almost half her size. Once at the top of the stairs, she wheels it into position at the lip of the door and begins her routine. Polanco first vacuums the rugs, then bends to reach the area under the bed. She moves the furniture, vacuums more, then dusts every surface of the room. This is followed by scrubbing, the bathtubs, the toilets, the sinks. You get the idea. After 30 or so minutes, her routine is complete, and she stands at the top of the stairs, her vacuum in one hand, a sack of dirty bed linens in the other.
Now we go to laundry. Okay?
Of course, there are thousands of women like Polanco, hotel maids who spend their days lugging heavy equipment around endless hallways, women who literally spend almost every moment of their working lives engaged in some kind of physical activity. But according to Ellen Langer, a psychologist at Harvard University who decided to use hotel maids to investigate the relationship between weight and mindset, most of these women don't see themselves as physically active people.
67% of them reported that they don't exercise. More than a third of those said that they didn't get any exercise. Now, given that they're exercising all day long, this seemed to be bizarre.
What was even more bizarre to Langer was despite the fact that all 84 women in her study far exceeded the Surgeon General's recommendation about amount of daily exercise, the bodies of the women didn't seem to benefit from their activity. Langer and her team measured their body fat, their waist-to-hip ratio, their blood pressure, their weight, their body mass index.
On all of these indicators, they matched their perceived amount of exercise rather than their actual amount of exercise.
And so Langer wondered what would happen if you changed their perception. To figure this out, she divided the group in two. With half the women, the researchers sat down and carefully went through each of the tasks they did each day, explaining how many calories those tasks burned, and informing the women that they already met the Surgeon General's definition of an active lifestyle. The other half got no information. 1 month later, Langer and her team returned to take measurements and were surprised by what they found in the group that had been educated.
A decrease in their systolic blood pressure, a decrease in their weight, a decrease in their body mass index, and a decrease in their waist-to-hip ratio.
In fact, blood pressure alone dropped 10% on average. Now, one possible explanation is that the process of learning about the amount of exercise they were already getting somehow changed the behavior of the maids. But Langer says that her team surveyed both the women and their managers and found no indication that the maids had altered their routines in any way, which led Langer to this conclusion.
The only thing to which we could attribute this improvement was their change of mindset.
Essentially, Langer is talking about a placebo effect. She's saying that if you believe you're exercising, your body will respond as if it is, in the same way that if you believe you're getting medication when you're actually getting a sugar pill, your body can sometimes respond as if it is. Now, to be clear, Langer is not arguing that you can sit around eating chocolate all day, believe that the chocolate will lead to weight loss, and end up skinnier.
I'm not saying that the effect we can have over our health and well-being is unlimited. What I'm suggesting is that we don't know what those limits are.
In fact, Langer talks about this study as part of a larger body of research which explores the connection between mind and body. For example, research about the effects of emotional stress on physical well-being and health. But Martin Binks, a director of behavioral health at the Duke Diet and Fitness Center, feels that, at least in terms of this particular study, the connection between the mind and the body remains unproven.
They can't really claim what they're claiming.
Binks, who's spent most of his professional life at the Diet and Fitness Center trying to track the reasons people do and do not lose weight, says that though he agrees that the changes in the women's bodies were real, because Langer only used a questionnaire to track the women's eating and exercise practices during the period of the study, she can't definitively say that the only thing that changed was their mindset.
There's a very high likelihood that those people behaved differently after they received that information, and they were being more active or they were eating more healthfully that resulted in their improvements in health.
But Binks has a more substantive criticism. He does not believe that placebos are capable of producing the kind of objective change in the physical body that Langer is claiming.
Generally, what placebos work on are subjective types of findings.
In other words, placebos can help change something like your perception of pain, or perhaps your sense of whether or not you feel depressed, but can't do something objective, like shrink a tumor or cut 3 pounds off your waistline, as the Langer study claims. Or can it?
The idea that you see a placebo when it's subjective, but you don't see a placebo effect when it's objective, really doesn't hold up.
This is Howard Brody, director of the Institute for Medical Humanities at the University of Texas, and author of the book The Placebo Response. Brody, who spent years looking at this issue, says that focused research into the possibilities and limits of the placebo effect is actually relatively new. Apparently, placebo research didn't really take off until 2001, when the National Institutes of Health convened a conference on the subject. Since then, however, our understanding of placebos has advanced significantly, and there are now a number of studies which challenge the old assumption that the effect can only alter subjective perception. Brody points to just one example.
They have given asthmatic patients a drug that tightens up your airways and makes breathing harder, a drug that worsens asthma. And they've given it to asthmatic patients and told them it was a drug that relieves asthma. And a significant number of those patients said, my asthma symptoms got better when you gave me the drug. And they measured better when you measured lung findings. So the idea that the placebo effect is restricted only to subjective states of the brain, I think, is really one that we have to dismiss.
Brody agrees with Binks, however, that there appear to be real limits to what a placebo can accomplish. For Brody, those limits involve the intensity of disease. He uses the metaphor of a gently moving stream versus a raging torrent.
If the disease process you're trying to intervene and change is a gently moving brook or stream, you could see how the placebo could be very powerful. If the disease process is more like a raging torrent or a waterfall, you could see how the placebo might not be very effective in reversing it. So most cancers, for example, are much more like the raging waterfall than they are like the babbling brook. And so that would explain why it's going to be very unusual to see a placebo that shrinks a tumor.
Fortunately for hotel maids and the rest of us who spend time each week hauling dirty laundry and toiling over the kitchen floor, the placebo effect just might apply here. And perhaps listening to this story will knock a couple pounds off the scale. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Just in case that's not enough for you, you can find a vitamin to boost your brain power or find out what the real secret is to a long life by going to our website, npr.org/yourhealth.
The number of overdoses on heroin and opiates such as OxyContin has gone up dramatically over the last decade. In fact, users of those drugs are more likely to die from an overdose than to die from AIDS or hepatitis or murder. Public health workers around the country have responded by handing out drug rescue kits to users. They cost just $9.50. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
You can find one of the new rescue operations near Central Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's off a side street behind St. Peter's Episcopal Church, through an anonymous-looking door, and up some stairs to a program called Cambridge Cares.
Hi.
Are you Richard?
Yeah, I'm Richard.
Hi. Well, how are you doing?
Good, you?
Glad to meet you. Are you cold?
A little bit.
Health educator Eliza Wheeler cajoles drug users to get tested for HIV and hepatitis, urges them not to share needles, gets them into detox or methadone treatment. On this wintry morning, she's teaching a 34-year-old woman named Alyssa how to rescue her friends from a fatal overdose. Alyssa's been on methadone for 6 years, but she occasionally uses heroin when she's under stress.
All right, so Alyssa, the first thing I'm going to do is kind of ask a series of questions about current drug use. So we're going to talk about just the last 30 days.
Alyssa's had scary experiences with overdoses, her own and others.
I managed to wake my partner up, who had turned blue. He was not breathing, which is why I called the ambulance. But I managed to wake him up before they came, and they didn't, you know, take him away. So he went out and convinced them that he was okay.
Wheeler runs through the signs of heroin overdose.
So the first thing you want to do is kind of figure out if they're overdosing.
There's when this happens, she says, the first thing to do is call 911. Then you blow some air into the person's lungs, a modified form of CPR called rescue breathing. Then you open up the overdose rescue kit.
This is what the box looks like. And then attached to the box is a little apparatus that makes it into a spray. So it's just a nasal spray. It's no injection.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's so wonderful. I thought it was a shot. That makes me feel so much better about everything.
The nasal spray is a drug called Naloxone, or Narcan. It blocks the brain receptors that heroin activates, instantly reversing an overdose. Doctors and EMTs have used Narcan for years, but it doesn't require much training because it's impossible to overdose on Narcan. The Cambridge program began putting Narcan kits into drug users' hands last August. Since then, the kits have been used to reverse 7 overdoses. New data compiled for NPR from 16 such programs across the nation show that more than 2,500 overdoses have been reversed. John Gatto directs the Cambridge program.
In the work that we do, oftentimes the results are very intangible. This is amazing to be involved in something that literally can save people's lives. Why wouldn't we do it?
Dr. Bertha Madras has a bunch of reasons why not. She's deputy director of the White House Office on National Drug Control Policy. She's dead set against the Narcan overdose rescue programs.
First of all, I don't agree with giving an opioid antidote to non-medical professionals. That's number one. I just don't think that's good public health policy.
Madras says fellow drug users aren't competent to deal with an overdose emergency. But more important, she says, Narcan kits are merely a stopgap that may encourage a person to keep using heroin and take away the motivation to get into detox and drug treatment.
Sometimes having an overdose, being in an emergency room, having that contact with a healthcare professional is enough to make a person snap into the reality of the situation and snap into having someone give them services.
There's not much research on the effect of Narcan kits, but one small study suggests that overdose rescue programs actually reduce heroin use and get some drug users into treatment. Karen Seal of the University of California at San Francisco is an author of that study.
It was one of these great studies where we just kind of all walked away and said, whoa, you know, this is terrific. I mean, by our sheer interaction with these folks around, you know, life-saving behaviors, we're actually creating some real positive change here.
Eliza Wheeler, the Cambridge health educator, says putting overdose rescue kits in the hands of drug users sends them a positive message.
There's a real potential culture change among drug users because of Narcan, because from my experience, I feel like drug users internalize a lot of stigma that's out in the world about them and come to believe that dying is just a part of this, the life that they've chosen.
So far, Narcan rescue programs have sprung up in big cities and rural areas around the country with little or no opposition. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.